just a sudden squall of fish raining from the sky. But who's to say my boss would even believe me, he asked himself. Say I told him the whole story, that the day before this happened a weird old guy stopped by the police box and predicted there'd be a shower of fish. He'd think I've completely lost it, and the story would make the rounds of the precinct, getting fishier with each retelling, and ending up as a running joke with himself as the butt of it. One more thing, the policeman thought. That old man had come to report that he'd murdered somebody. To give himself up, in other words. And I didn't take him seriously. Didn't even note it in the logbook. This was definitely against regulations, and I could be brought up on charges. But the old man's story was so preposterous. No police officer would ever take it seriously. It's a madhouse manning the police box sometimes, with paperwork up to here. The world's filled with people with a screw loose, and as if by agreement, at one time or another, they all seem to find their way into police boxes to blab out some nonsense. If you took every one of these nutcases seriously, you'd go nuts yourself. And yet that prediction about fish raining from the sky, a lunatic statement if there ever was one, actually did happen, so maybe, just maybe, that story he told about knifing somebody to death, Johnny Walker, as he put it, might actually be true. Assuming it was, this was a major problem, for he turned away someone confessing to murder and didn't even write up a report on it. In the end, the dust cart came and cleaned up all the mounds of fish. The young policeman directed traffic, blocking off the entrance to the shopping district so cars couldn't come in. Fish scales were stuck to the street in front of the shops and wouldn't come off, no matter how much they were hosed down. The street remained wet for some time, causing a couple of housewives on bicycles to slip and fall. The place reeked of fish for days afterwards, getting the neighbourhood cats all worked up. The policeman was kept busy with the clean-up and didn't have time to think any more about the strange old man. The day after it rained fish, though, the policeman gulped in shock when the body of a man, stabbed to death, was discovered nearby. The dead man was a famous sculptor, and his body was discovered by the cleaning woman who came every other day. The body was naked, lying in a pool of blood. Estimated time of death was in the evening, 2 days previously, the murder weapon a steak knife from the man's own kitchen. To his dismay, the young policeman finally believed what the old man had told him. "My God," he thought, "what a complete mess I've got myself into. I should have called up the station and taken the old man in. He confessed to murder, so I should have handed him over to the higher-ups and let them decide if he's crazy or not. But I shirked my duty. Now that it's come to this," the young policeman decided, "the best thing to do is to just clam up and pretend it never happened." But by this time, Nakata was no longer in the city.
19. It's Monday, and the library's closed. The library is quiet enough most of the time, but on a day like this, when it's closed, it's like the land that time forgot. Or more like a place that's holding its breath, hoping time won't stumble upon it. Down the corridor from the reading room, past a staff-only sign, there's a sink area where you could make coffee or tea, and there's a microwave oven too. Just past this is the door to the guest room, which includes a simple bathroom and wardrobe. Next to the single bed is a bedside table, outfitted with a reading lamp and alarm clock. There's also a little writing desk with a lamp on it, plus an old-fashioned set of chairs covered in white cloth for receiving guests, and a chest of drawers for clothes. On a small, bachelor-size fridge are some dishes and a small shelf for stowing them away. If you feel like making a simple meal, the kitchen area is right outside. The bathroom has a shower, soap and shampoo, a hairdryer and towels. Everything you need for a comfortable short stay. Through a west-facing window, you can see the trees in the garden. It's getting close to evening, and the sinking sun glints past the cedar branches. "I've stayed here a couple of times when it was too much trouble to go home," Oshima says. "But nobody else uses the room. As far as I know, Miss Sayaki never uses it. It's not going to put anybody out, your staying here, is what I'm trying to say." I set my backpack on the floor and look around my new lodgings. There's a clean set of sheets and enough in the fridge to tide you over. Milk, some fruit, vegetables, butter, ham, cheese. Not enough for a decent meal, but enough for a sandwich or salad at least. If you want something more, I suggest takeaway or going out to eat. For laundry, you'll have to make do with rinsing things out in the bathroom, I'm afraid. Let's see, have I forgotten anything? Where does Miss Psyche usually work? Ushima points to the ceiling. You remember that room on the first floor you saw on the tour? She's always there, writing. If I have to go out for a while, she sometimes comes down and takes over at the reception desk. But unless she's got something to do on the ground floor, that's where you'll find her. I nod. I'll be here tomorrow before 10 to run through what your job involves. Until then, just relax and take it easy. Thanks for everything, I tell him. My pleasure, he replies. After he leaves, I unload my backpack, arrange my meager assortment of clothes in the chest of drawers, hang up my shirts and jacket, line up my notebook and pens on the desk, put my toiletries in the bathroom, and finally stow the pack itself in the wardrobe. The room doesn't have any decorations at all, except for a small oil painting, a realistic portrait of a young boy by the shore. Not bad, I decide. Maybe done by somebody famous. The boy looks about 12 or so, and he's wearing a white sun hat and sitting on a small deck chair. His elbows on one of the arms of the chair, his chin resting in his hand. He looks a little sad, but kind of pleased too. A black German shepherd sits next to the boy, as though he's guarding him. In the background is the sea and a couple of other people, but they're too far away to make out their faces. A small island's visible, and a few fist-shaped clouds float over the water. Most definitely a summer scene. I sit at the desk and gaze at the painting for a while. I begin to feel as though I can hear the crash of waves, smell the saltiness of the sea. The boy in the painting might be the boy who used to live in this room, the young man Miss Saiki loved. The one who got caught up in the student movement clashes and was pointlessly beaten to death. There's no way of knowing for sure, but I'm betting that's who it is. The scenery looks a lot like what you see around here, for one thing. If that's the case, then it must be from about 40 years ago, an eternity to somebody like me. I try imagining myself in 40 years' time, but it's like trying to picture what lies beyond the universe. The next morning, Ushima arrives and shows me what I'm supposed to do to get the library ready to open. First, I have to unlock and open the windows to air the rooms, make a quick pass with the Hoover, wipe the desktops, change the flowers in the vases, turn on the lights, occasionally sprinkle water in the garden to keep down the dust, and when the time comes, open the door. At closing time, it's the same procedure in reverse. Lock the windows, wipe the desktops again, turn off the lights, and close the front door. There's not much for anybody to steal here, so maybe we don't need to be so worried about always locking the door, Ushima tells me. But Miss Saiki and I don't like things done sloppily. So we try to do things by the book. This is our house, so we treat it with respect. And I hope you'll do the same. I nod. Next, he shows me what to do at the reception desk, how to help people coming to use the library. For the time being, you should just sit next to me and watch what I do. It's not all that difficult. If something ever comes up that you can't deal with, just go upstairs and ask Miss Saiki. She'll take care of it. Miss Saiki arrives just before 11. Her Volkswagen Golf makes a distinctive roar as it pulls up, and I can tell right away it's her. She parks, comes in through the back door, and greets the two of us. Morning, she says. Good morning, we answer back. That's the extent of our conversation. Miss Saiki has on a navy blue short-sleeved dress, a cotton coat in her arms, a shoulder bag. Nothing you could call an accessory, and hardly a hint of makeup. Still, there's something about her that's dazzling. She glances at me standing next to Ushima, and looks for a moment as if she wants to say something, but doesn't. She merely beams a slight smile in my direction, and walks up to her office on the first floor. Not to worry, Ushima assures me. She has no problem with your being here. She doesn't go in for a lot of small talk, that's all. At 11, Ushima and I open the main door. but nobody comes for a while. During the interval, he shows me how to use the computers to search for books. They're typical library PCs I'm familiar with. Next, he shows me how to arrange the catalogue carts. Every day, the library receives copies of newly published books, and one of the other tasks is to log in these new arrivals by hand. Around 11:30, two women come in together, wearing identical jeans. The shorter of the two has cropped hair like a swimmer, while the taller woman wears her hair pulled back. Both of them have on jogging shoes, one a pair of Nikes, the other Asics. The tall one looks around 40 or so, with glasses and a checked shirt. The shorter woman, a decade younger, is wearing a white blouse. Both have little rucksacks on, and expressions as gloomy as a cloudy day. Neither one says much. Oshima relieves them of their rucksacks at the entrance, and the women, looking displeased, extract notebooks and pens before abandoning them. The women go through to the library, checking the stacks one by one, earnestly flipping through the card catalogue, occasionally taking notes. They don't read anything or sit down. They act less like people using a library than inspectors from the tax office checking a company's inventory. Oshima and I can't work out who they are or what they could possibly be up to. He gives me a significant look and shrugs. I don't have a good feeling about this, to put it mildly. At noon, while Oshima goes out to the garden to eat his lunch, I take his place behind the counter. "Excuse me, but I have a question," one of the women comes over and says. The tall one. Her tone of voice is tough and unyielding, like a loaf of bread someone forgot on the back of a shelf. "Yes, what can I do for you?" She frowns and looks at me as though I'm some off-kilter picture frame. "Aren't you a high school student?" "Yes, that's right, I'm a trainee," I answer. "Is there one of your superiors I could talk to?" I go to the garden to get Oshima. Slowly, he takes a sip of coffee to dissolve the bite of food in his mouth, brushes the crumbs from his lap, and comes inside. "Yes, may I help you?" Oshima asks her amiably. "Just to let you know, we're investigating public cultural facilities in the entire country from a woman's point of view, looking at ease of use, fair access, and other issues," she says. "Our group is doing a year-long investigation and plans to publish a public report on our findings. A large number of women are involved in this project, and the two of us happen to be in charge of this region." "If you don't mind," Oshima says, "would you tell me the name of this organization?" The woman whips out a business card and passes it to him. His expression unchanged, Oshima reads it carefully, places it on the counter, then looks up with a blazing smile and gazes intently at the woman. A first-class smile, guaranteed to make any red-blooded woman blush. This woman, strangely enough, doesn't react, not even a twitch of an eyebrow. "What we've concluded is that, unfortunately, this library has several issues which need to be addressed." "From the viewpoint of women, is what you're saying," Oshima commented. "Correct. From the viewpoint of women," the woman answers. She clears her throat. "And we'd like to take this up with your administration and hear their response, if you don't mind." "We don't have anything as fancy as an administration, but I would be happy to listen to you." "Well, first of all, you have no toilets set aside for women. That's correct, isn't it?" "Yes, that's right. There's no women's toilet in this library. We have one toilet for the use of both men and women." "Even if you are a private institution, since you're open to the public, don't you think, in principle, that you should provide separate toilets for women and men?"
"In principle," Oshima says.
"Correct. Shared facilities give rise to all sorts of harassment. According to our survey, the majority of women are reluctant to use shared toilets. This is a clear case of neglect of your female patrons."
"Neglect," Oshima says, and makes a face as though he's swallowed something bitter by mistake. He doesn't much like the sound of the word, it would seem.
"An intentional oversight."
"Intentional oversight," he repeats, and gives some thought to this clumsy phrase.
"So what's your reaction to all this?" the woman asks, barely containing her irritation.
"As you can see," Oshima says, "we're a very small library. and unfortunately, we don't have the space for separate toilets. Naturally, it would be better to have separate facilities, but none of our patrons has ever complained. For better or for worse, our library doesn't get very crowded. If you'd like to pursue this issue of separate toilets further, I suggest you go to the Boeing headquarters in Seattle and address the issue of toilets on 747s. A 747's much bigger than our little library and much more crowded. As far as I'm aware, all toilets on passenger aircraft are shared by men and women. The tall woman frowns at him severely, her cheekbones jutting forward and her glasses riding up her nose. We're not investigating aeroplanes. 747s are beside the point. Wouldn't toilets in both jets and in our library, in principle, give rise to the same sorts of problems? We are investigating one by one public facilities. We're not here to argue over principles. Orshima's supple smile never fades during this exchange. Is that so? I could have sworn that principles were exactly what we were discussing. The woman realizes she's blown it. She blushes a bit, though not because of Oshima's sex appeal. She tries a different tack. At any rate, jumbo jets are irrelevant here. Don't try to confuse the issue. Understood. No more aeroplanes, Oshima promises. We'll bring things down to earth. The woman glares at him, and after taking a breath, forges on. One other issue I'd like to raise is how you have authors here separated by sex. Yes, that's right. The person who was in charge before us catalogued these, and for whatever reason divided them into male and female. We were thinking of recataloguing all of them, but haven't been able to as of yet. We're not criticizing you for this, she says. Oshima tilts his head. The problem, though, is that in all categories, male authors are listed before female authors, she says. To our way of thinking, this violates the principle of sexual equality and is grossly unfair. Oshima picks up her business card again, runs his eyes over it, then lays it back down on the counter. Miss Soga, he begins. When they called the register in school, your name would have come before Miss Tanaka and after Miss Sekine. Did you file a complaint about that? Did you object, asking them to reverse the order? Does G get angry because it follows F in the alphabet? Does page 68 in a book start a revolution just because it follows 67? That's not the point, she says angrily. You're intentionally confusing the issue. Hearing this, the shorter woman, who'd been standing in front of a stack taking notes, races over. Intentionally confusing the issue, Oshima repeats, as if he's underlining the woman's words. Are you denying it? That's a red herring, Oshima replies. The woman named Soga stands there, mouth ajar, not saying a word. In English, there's this expression, red herring. Something that's very interesting but leads you astray from the main topic. I'm afraid I haven't looked into why they use that kind of expression, though. Herrings or mackerel or whatever, you're dodging the issue. In fact, what I'm doing is shifting the analogy, Oshima says. One of the most effective methods of argument, according to Aristotle. The citizens of ancient Athens enjoyed using this kind of intellectual trick very much. Though, of course, it's a shame that at the time, women were not included within the definition of citizen. Are you making fun of us? Oshima shakes his head. Look, what I'm trying to get across is this. I'm sure there are many more effective ways of making sure that Japanese women's rights are guaranteed than sniffing around a small library in a provincial town and complaining about the toilets and the card catalogue. We're doing our level best to see that this modest library of ours helps the community. We've assembled an outstanding collection for people who love books, and we do our utmost to put a human face on all our dealings with the public. You might not be aware of it, but this library's collection of poetry-related material from the 1910s to the mid-Showa period is nationally recognized. Naturally, there are things we could do better, as also limits to what we can accomplish. But rest assured, we're doing our very best. I think it'd be a whole lot better if you focused on what we do well than on what we're unable to do. Isn't that what you'd call fair? The tall woman looks at the short one, who looks back up at her and opens her mouth for the first time.
You've just been evading the point, mouthing empty arguments that avoid taking responsibility, she says in a really high-pitched voice. In reality, to use the term for the sake of convenience, what you're doing is making an easygoing attempt at self-justification. You're a totally pathetic, historical example of the phallocentric, to put it mildly.
A pathetic, historical example, Oshima repeats, obviously impressed. By his tone of voice, he seems to like the sound of that phrase.
In other words, you're a typical sexist, patriarchal male, the tall one pipes up, unable to conceal her irritation.
A patriarchal male, Oshima repeats once more. The short one ignores this and goes on.
You're employing the status quo and the cheap phallocentric logic that supports it to reduce the entire female gender to second-class citizens, to limit and deprive women of the rights they're due. You're doing this unconsciously rather than deliberately, but that makes you even guiltier. You protect vested male interests and become inured to the pain of others, and don't even try to see what evil your blindness causes women in society. I realize that problems with toilets and card catalogues are mere details, but if we don't begin with the small things, we'll never be able to throw off the cloak of blindness that covers our society. Those are our action principles. That's the way every sensible woman feels, the tall one adds, her face expressionless.
How could any woman of generous spirit behave otherwise given the torments that I face, Oshima says. The two women stand there as silent as icebergs. Electra, by Sophocles. A wonderful play. And, by the way, the term gender was originally used to indicate grammatical gender. My feeling is that the word sex is more accurate in terms of indicating physical sexual difference. Using gender here is incorrect, to put a linguistic fine point upon it. A frozen silence follows.
At any rate, what you've been saying is fundamentally wrong, Oshima says, calmly yet emphatically. I am most definitely not a pathetic, historical example of a patriarchal male.
Then explain simply what's wrong with what we've said, the shorter woman says defiantly, without sidestepping the issue or trying to show off how erudite you are, the tall one adds.
All right. I'll do just that. Explain it simply and honestly, minus any sidestepping or displays of brilliance, Oshima says.
We're waiting, the tall one says, and the short one gives a compact nod to show she agrees.
First of all, I'm not a male, Oshima announces.
A dumbfounded silence follows on the part of everybody. I gulp and shoot Oshima a glance.
I'm a woman, he says. I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't make jokes, the short woman says, after a pause for breath. Not with much confidence, though. It's more that she felt somebody had to say something.
Oshima pulls his wallet out of his chinos, takes out the driver's license, and passes it to the woman. She reads what's written there, frowns, and hands it to her tall companion, who reads it and, after a moment's hesitation, gives it back to Oshima, a sour look on her face.
Did you want to see it too? Oshima asks me.
When I shake my head, he slips the license back into his wallet and puts the wallet into his trouser pocket. He then places both hands on the counter and says,
As you can see, biologically and legally, I am undeniably female.
Which is why what you've been saying about me is fundamentally wrong. It's simply impossible for me to be, as you put it, a typical sexist patriarchal male.
Yes, but, the tall woman says, and then stops.
The short one, lips pursed, is playing with her collar. My body is physically female, but my mind's completely male, Oshima goes on. Emotionally, I live as a man. So I suppose your notion of being a historical example may be correct. And who knows if I'm a notorious sexist? But I'm not a lesbian, even though I dress this way. My sexual preference is for men. In other words, I'm a female, but I'm gay. I do anal sex, and have never used my vagina for sex. My clitoris is sensitive, but my breasts aren't. I don't have periods. So, what am I discriminating against? Could somebody enlighten me? The three of us listening are flabbergasted and don't say a word. One of the women clears her throat, and the jarring sound reverberates through the room. The clock on the wall loudly ticks away the seconds. I'm so sorry, Oshima says, but I'm in the middle of lunch. I'm having a tuna spinach wrap, and had eaten half of it when you asked me over. If I leave it much longer, the neighborhood cats will make a grab for it. People throw away kittens they don't want in the woods near the sea, so this neighborhood is full of cats. If you don't mind, I'd like to get back to my lunch. So excuse me, but please take your time and enjoy the library. Our library is open to everyone. As long as you follow the rules and don't bother the other patrons, feel free to do whatever you'd like. You can look at whatever you want. Go ahead and write whatever you like in your report. We won't mind. We don't receive any funding from anywhere, and pretty much do things our own way. And that's the way we like it. After Oshima leaves, the two women share a look. Then they both stare at me. Perhaps they take me for Oshima's lover or something. I don't say a word, and start arranging catalogue cards. The two of them whisper to each other in the stacks, and before long, they gather their belongings and start to make a move. Frozen looks on their faces, they don't utter a word of thanks when I hand back their rucksacks. After a while, Oshima finishes his lunch and comes back inside. He hands me two spinach wraps made of tuna and vegetables enclosed in a kind of green tortilla with a white cream sauce on top. I eat these for my lunch. I boil some water and have a cup of Earl Grey to wash it down. Everything I said a while ago is true, Oshima tells me when I come back from lunch. So that's what you meant when you told me you were a special person. I wasn't trying to brag or anything, he says. But you understand that I wasn't exaggerating, right? I nod. Oshima smiles. In terms of sex, I'm most definitely female, though my breasts haven't developed much and I've never had a period. But I don't have a penis or testicles or facial hair. In short, I have nothing. A nice, no extra baggage kind of feeling, if you want to put a positive spin on it. Though I doubt you can appreciate how that feels. I guess not, I say. Sometimes I don't understand it myself. I ask myself, what the hell am I anyway? Really, what am I? I shake my head. Well, I don't know what I am either. A classic identity crisis. I nod. But at least you know where to begin, unlike me. I don't care what you are. Whatever you are, I like you, I tell him. I've never said this to anybody in my whole life, and the words make me blush. I appreciate it, Oshima says, and lays a gentle hand on my shoulder. I know I'm a little different from everyone else, but still I'm a human being. That's what I'd like you to realize. I'm just a normal person, not some monster. I feel the same things everyone else does, act the same way. Sometimes, though, that small difference feels like an abyss. But I guess there's not much I can do about it. He picks up a long, sharpened pencil from the counter and gazes at it, as if it's an extension of himself. I wanted to tell you all this as soon as I could, directly, rather than have you hear it from someone else. so I guess today was a good opportunity. It wasn't such a pleasant experience, though, was it? I shake my head. I've experienced all kinds of discrimination, Oshima says. Only people who've been discriminated against can really know how much it hurts. Each person feels the pain in his own way. Each has his own scars. So I think I'm as concerned about fairness and justice as anybody. But what disgusts me even more are people who have no imagination. The kind T.S. Eliot calls hollow men. People who fill up that lack of imagination with heartless bits of straw, not even aware of what they're doing. Callous people who throw a lot of empty words at you, trying to force you to do what you don't want to. Like that lovely pair we just met. He sighs and twirls the long, slender pencil in his hand. Gays, lesbians, straights, feminists, fascist pigs, communists, Hare Krishnas, none of those bother me. I don't care what banner they raise. But what I can't stand are hollow people. When I'm with them, I can't bear it, and end up saying things I shouldn't. With those women, I should have just let it wash over me, or else called Miss Saiki and let her handle it. She would have given them a smile and smoothed things over. But I can't do that. I say things I shouldn't, do things I shouldn't do. I can't control myself. That's one of my weak points. Do you know why that's a weak point of mine? 'Cause if you take every single person who lacks much imagination seriously, there's no end to it, I say. That's it, Oshima says. He taps his temple with the rubber end of the pencil. But there's one thing I want you to remember, Kafka. Those are precisely the kind of people who murdered Miss Saiki's childhood sweetheart. Narrow minds devoid of imagination. Intolerance, theories cut off from reality, empty terminology, usurped ideals, inflexible systems. Those are the things that really frighten me. What I absolutely fear and loathe. Of course it's important to know what's right and what's wrong. Individual errors in judgment can usually be corrected. As long as you have the courage to admit mistakes, things can be turned around. But intolerant, narrow minds with no imagination are like parasites that transform the host, change form, and continue to thrive. They're a lost cause, and I don't want anyone like that coming in here. Oshima points at the stacks with the tip of his pencil. What he means, of course, is the entire library. I wish I could just laugh off people like that, but I can't.
20. It was already past 8 p.m. when the 18-wheeler refrigerated lorry pulled off the Tomei Highway and let Nakata out in the car park of the Fujigawa rest area. Canvas bag and umbrella in hand, he clambered down from the passenger seat to the asphalt. "Good luck finding another ride," the driver said, sticking his head out the window. "If you ask around, I'm sure you'll find something."
"Much obliged. Nakata appreciates all your help."
"Take it easy," the driver said, then waved and pulled back onto the highway.
"Fujigawa," the driver had said. Nakata had no idea where Fujigawa was, though he did understand he'd left Tokyo and was heading west. No need for a compass or a map to tell him that, he knew it instinctively. Now if only a lorry going west would give him a ride. Nakata was hungry and decided to have a bowl of ramen in the rest area restaurant. The rice balls and chocolate in his bag he wanted to save for an emergency. Not being able to read, it took a while to work out how to buy a meal. Before going into the dining hall, you had to buy meal tickets from a vending machine, and he had to have somebody help him read the buttons.
"My eyes are bad, so I can't see too well," he told a middle-aged woman, and she inserted the money for him, pushed the right button, and handed him his change.
Experience had taught him it was better not to let on that he didn't know how to read, because when he did, people stared at him as though he was some kind of monster.
After his meal, Nakata, umbrella in hand, bag slung over his shoulder, made the rounds of the lorries in the car park, asking for a ride.
"I'm heading west," he explained, "and I wonder if you'd be kind enough to give me a ride."
But the drivers all took one look at him and shook their heads. An elderly hitchhiker was pretty unusual, and they were naturally wary of anything out of the ordinary.
"Our company doesn't allow us to pick up hitchhikers," they all said. "Sorry."
It had taken a long time to get from Nakano Ward to the entrance of the Tomei Highway. He'd never been out of Nakano before, and had no idea where the highway was. He had a special pass he could use for the city bus line, but he'd never ridden by himself on the underground or train where you needed to buy a ticket. It was just before 10 a.m. when he packed a change of clothes, toiletries, and some snacks in his bag, carefully put the cash he'd hidden under the tatami in a money belt for safekeeping, and then, the large umbrella in hand, left his apartment. When he asked the city bus driver how he could get to the highway, the man laughed.
"This bus only goes to the Shinjuku station. City buses don't go on the highway. You'll have to take a highway bus."
"Where can I get a highway bus that goes on the Tomei Highway?"
"Tokyo Station," the driver replied. "Take this bus to Shinjuku Station, then take a train to Tokyo Station where you can buy a reserved seat ticket. The buses there will take you to the Tomei Highway."
Nakata wasn't at all sure what he meant, but went ahead and took the bus as far as Shinjuku. But when he got there, he was overwhelmed. The massive station was jammed with people, and he had trouble moving through the crowds. There were so many train lines, too, that he couldn't work out which one went to Tokyo Station. Since he couldn't read the signs, he asked a few passers-by, but their explanations were too fast, too complicated, and full of place names he didn't recognize.
"I might as well be talking to Kawamura," Nakata thought to himself.
There was always a police box to ask directions at, but he was afraid they'd mistake him for a senile old person and take him into custody, something he'd experienced once before. As he wandered around near the station, the exhaust fumes and noise got to him, and he started to feel sick. Avoiding the crowded pavements, he found a small park set between two high-rise buildings and sat down on a bench. Nakata was completely at a loss. He sat there, muttering occasionally, rubbing the top of his close-cropped head. There wasn't a cat to be seen in the park. There were plenty of crows, though, squawking down and rummaging through the litter bins. Nakata looked up at the sky a few times, and from the sun's position could guess the approximate time. Because of all the exhaust fumes, perhaps, the sky was covered in a strange color. At noon, office workers from the nearby buildings flooded out to eat lunch in the park. Nakata ate the bean jam buns he'd brought with him, washing them down with hot tea from his thermos. Two young women sat down together on the bench beside his, and he decided to talk to them.
"How can I get to the Tomei Highway?" he asked.
They told him the same thing the city bus driver had said. "Take the Chuo line to Tokyo Station, then a Tomei Highway bus."
"Nakata tried that, but it didn't work," Nakata admitted. "I've never been out of Nakano Ward before, so I don't know how to take the train. I just know how to ride the city bus. I can't read, so I can't buy a ticket. I took the city bus here, but don't know how to go any further."
"You can't read?"
they asked, astonished. He seemed like a harmless enough old man, a nice smile, dressed neatly. Carrying an umbrella on such a fine day like this was a bit odd, but he didn't appear to be homeless. A pleasant face, especially those bright-looking eyes.
"Do you really mean to say you've never been outside Nakano Ward?"
the girl with black hair asked.
"Yes, I've tried not ever to go out of it. If Nakata got lost, there's nobody who'd come looking for me."
"And you can't read,"
said the other girl, the one with dyed brownish hair.
"That's right. I can't read at all. I can understand simple numbers, but can't add."
I imagine it would be hard for you to take a train."
"Yes, it's very hard. I can't buy a ticket."
If we had time, we could take you to the station and make sure you got on the right train. But we have to get back to work soon. I'm really sorry.
No, no need to apologize. I'll work it out somehow.
I've got it, the girl with black hair exclaimed. Didn't Togeguchi over in sales say he had to go to Yokohama today?
Yes, now that you mention it. He'd help out if we asked him. He's a little on the gloomy side, but not a bad guy, really, the brown-haired girl said.
Since you can't read, maybe it'd be better to hitchhike, the black-haired girl said.
Hitchhike?
Ask for a lift from somebody. Mostly it ends up being lifts with long-haul lorry drivers. Regular cars generally don't pick up hitchhikers.
Nakata's not sure what long-haul lorry drivers are.
As long as you go there, it'll work out.
I hitchhiked once when I was in college. Lorry drivers are all nice guys. How far are you going on the Tomei Highway? The brown-haired girl asked.
Nakata doesn't know, Nakata replied.
You don't know?
I'll know when I get there. So I'll start by going west on the Tomei Highway. After that, I'll think about where I'll go. Anyway, I have to go west.
The two girls looked at each other, but Nakata's words were strangely persuasive, and they found themselves feeling kindly towards the old man. They finished their lunches, tossed their empty cans in the bin, and stood up.
"Why don't you come with us?" the black-haired girl said. "We'll work something out."
Nakata followed them into a nearby building. He'd never been in such a large building before. The two girls got him to sit at a bench next to the reception desk, then spoke to the receptionist and told Nakata to wait there for a while. They disappeared into one of the lifts in the lobby. As Nakata sat there, umbrella and canvas bag in hand, office workers streamed back inside after their lunch hour. Another scene he'd never laid eyes on before in his life. As if by mutual consent, all the people were well-dressed, ties, shiny briefcases and high heels, everyone rushing off in the same direction. For the life of him, Nakata couldn't understand what so many people like this could possibly be up to. After a time, the two girls came back, accompanied by a gangly young man wearing a white shirt and striped tie.
"This is Mr. Togeguchi," the brown-haired girl said. "He's going to drive to Yokohama, and he says he'll take you with him. He'll drop you at the Kohoku car park on the Tomei Highway, and hopefully you'll be able to find another lift there. Just go around telling people you want to go west, and when someone gives you a lift, be sure to buy them a meal when you stop somewhere. Do you follow?"
"But do you have enough money for that?" the black-haired one asked.
"Yes, I have enough.
Mr. Nakata's a friend of ours, so be nice to him," the brown-haired girl said to Togeguchi.
"If you'll be nice to me," the young man replied timidly. "One of these days," the black-haired one said. As they were saying goodbye, the girl said, "Here's a little going-away present for when you get hungry." They handed him some rice balls and a bar of chocolate they'd bought at a convenience store.
"I don't know how to thank you enough for all you've done," Nakata said. "I'll be praying that good things happen to you both."
"I hope your prayers come true," the brown-haired one said as her companion giggled.
The young man, Togeguchi, told Nakata to sit in the passenger seat of the Hiace van, then drove down the Metropolitan Highway and onto the Tomei. The traffic was backed up, so the two of them talked about all kinds of things as they inched along. Togeguchi was bashful and didn't say much at first, but after he got used to having Nakata with him, he started talking, to the point where it was less a conversation than a running monologue. There were a lot of things he wanted to talk about, and he found it easy to open up to a stranger like Nakata, whom he'd never see again. He explained that he'd broken up with his fiancée a few months ago. She'd had another boyfriend she'd secretly been seeing all the while. He said he didn't get along well with his bosses at work and was thinking of quitting. His parents had got divorced when he was in junior high, and his mother soon got remarried to some sleazeball. He'd lent money from his savings to a friend who didn't give any indication he'd be repaying him any time soon. And the college student who lived in the apartment next door blasted his music so loud he couldn't get much sleep. Nakata listened diligently, chiming in at appropriate points, tossing in an occasional opinion of his own. By the time their van pulled into the Kohoku car park, Nakata knew just about everything there was to know about the young man. There was a lot he didn't understand, but he did see the big picture of Togeguchi's life, namely that here was a poor young guy who, while trying to live an upright life, had his share of problems.
"Nakata's much obliged to you," he said. "Thank you so very much for the lift."
"I enjoyed it. Thanks to you, Mr. Nakata. I feel completely relaxed now. I've never talked to anyone like this before, and I'm happy I could tell you everything. I hope I haven't bored you with all my problems."
"No, not at all. Nakata's very happy, too, to be able to talk to you. I'm sure good things are going to happen to you, Mr. Togeguchi."
The young man took a phone card from his wallet and handed it to Nakata. "Please, take this card. My company makes them. Consider it a going-away present. I wish I could give you something better."
"Thank you very much,"
Nakata said, and tucked it carefully into his wallet. He had no one to phone, and didn't know how to use the card anyway, but he thought it was more polite to accept it. By now it was 3 p.m. It took another hour to find someone willing to take him as far as Fujigawa. The man was driving a refrigerated lorry hauling fresh fish, a beefy man in his mid-40s, with arms like logs and a jutting belly.
"I hope you don't mind the fish smell," the driver said.
"Fish are one of Nakata's favourites," Nakata replied.
The driver laughed.
"You're a strange one, aren't you?"
"People tell me that sometimes."
"I happen to like the strange ones," the driver said. "People who look normal and live a normal life, they're the ones you have to watch out for."
"Is that so?"
"Believe me, that's how it goes, in my opinion anyway."
"Nakata doesn't have many opinions, though I do like eel."
"Well, that's an opinion, that you like eel."
"Eel is an opinion?"
"Sure, saying you like eel's an opinion."
Thus the two of them drove to Fujigawa. The driver said his name was Hagita.
"Mr. Nakata, what do you think about the way the world's going?" he asked.
"I'm very sorry, I'm not bright, so I have no idea at all about that," Nakata said.
"Having your own opinion and not being very bright are two different things."
"But, Mr. Hagita, not being very bright means you can't think about things."
"But you did say you like eel."
"Yes, eel is one of Nakata's favourites."
"That's a connection, see?"
"Hmm.
Do you like chicken and egg over rice?"
"Yes, that's one of Nakata's favourites, too."
"Well, there's a connection there, too," Hagita said. "You build up relationships like that, one after another, and before you know it, you have meaning. The more connections, the deeper the meaning. Doesn't matter if it's eel, or rice bowls, or grilled fish, whatever. Get it?"
"No, I still don't understand. Does food make connections between things?"
"Not just food. Trams, the emperor, whatever."
"But I don't ride trams."
"That's fine. Look, what I'm getting at is no matter who or what you're dealing with, people build up meaning between themselves and the things around them. The important thing is whether this comes about naturally or not. Being bright has nothing to do with it. What matters is that you see things with your own eyes."
"You're very bright, Mr. Hagita."
Hagita let out a loud laugh.
"It isn't a question of intelligence. I'm not all that bright. I just have my own way of thinking. That's why people get disgusted with me. They accuse me of always bringing up things that are better left alone. If you try to use your head to think about things, people don't want to have anything to do with you."
"Nakata still doesn't understand. But are you saying that there's a link between liking eel and liking chicken and egg over rice?"
"You could put it that way, I suppose. There's always going to be a connection between you, Mr. Nakata, and the things you deal with, just like there's a connection between eel and rice bowls. And as the web of these connections spreads out, a relationship between you, Mr. Nakata, and capitalists and the proletariat naturally develops."
"Pro-lu-what?"
"The proletariat,"
said Mr. Hagita, taking his hands off the steering wheel and making a wide gesture. To Nakata, they looked as massive as baseball gloves.
"The people who work hard, who earn their bread through the sweat of their brow, those are the proletariat. On the other hand, you've got your guys who sit on their backsides, not lifting a finger, giving orders to other people and getting 100 times my salary. Those are your capitalists."
I don't know about people who are capitalists. I am poor, and I don't know anybody great like that. The greatest person I know is the governor of Tokyo. Is the governor a capitalist?
Yeah, I suppose. Governors are more likely to be capitalists' lapdogs, though.
The governor is a dog?
Nakata remembered the huge black dog who took him to Johnny Walker's house, and that ominous figure and the governor overlapped in his mind.
The world's swarming with those kind of dogs, pawns of the capitalist.
Pawns?
Like paws with an N.
Are there any capitalist cats?
Nakata asked. Hagita burst out laughing.
Boy, you are different, Mr. Nakata, but I like your style. Capitalist cats, that's a good one. A very unique opinion you have there.
Mr. Hagita?
Yeah.
I'm poor and received a subsidy every month from the governor. Was this the wrong thing to do?
How much do you get every month?
Nakata told him the amount. Hagita shook his head disgustedly.
Pretty damn hard to get by on so little.
That's not true, because Nakata doesn't use much money. Besides the subsidy, I get money by helping people find their lost cats.
No kidding. A professional cat finder,
Hagita said, impressed.
You're an amazing guy, I have to say.
Actually, I'm able to talk to cats, Nakata said. I can understand what they say. That helps me locate the missing ones.
Hagita nodded. I wouldn't put it past you.
But not long ago, I found out I couldn't talk to cats any more. I wonder why.
Things change every day, Mr. Nakata. With each new dawn, it's not the same world as the day before. And you're not the same person you were, either. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Connections change, too. Who's the capitalist? Who's the proletarian? Who's on the right? Who's on the left? The information revolution? Stock options? Floating assets? Occupational restructuring? Multinational corporations? What's good? What's bad? Boundaries between things are disappearing all the time. Maybe that's why you can't speak to cats anymore.
The difference between right and left, Nakata understands. This is right and this is left, correct?
You got it. Hagita agreed. That's all you need to know.
The last thing they did together was have a meal in a rest area restaurant. Hagita ordered 2 plates of eel, and when Nakata insisted on paying to thank him for the lift, the driver shook his head emphatically.
No way, he said. I'd never let you use the pittance they give you for a subsidy to feed me.
Much obliged, then. Thank you for such a treat,
Nakata said, happy to accept his kindness. Nakata spent an hour at the Fujigawa rest area, asking drivers for a lift, but couldn't find anyone willing to take him. He didn't panic, though, or get depressed. In his mind, time passed very slowly, or barely at all. He went outside for some air and wandered around. The sky was cloudless, the surface of the moon clearly visible. Nakata strolled around the car park, which was filled with countless huge lorries, like giant beasts lined up shoulder to shoulder, resting. Some of the lorries had at least 20 giant tires, each one as tall as a man. So many lorries, all racing down the highway so late at night. What could they possibly be carrying? Nakata couldn't imagine. If he could read the writing on the sides of the lorries, he wondered, would he be able to work it out? After an hour or so, he spotted 10 or so motorcycles lined up in a corner of the car park where there weren't many cars. A clump of young men stood nearby in a circle, looking at something and yelling. Intrigued, Nakata approached them. Maybe they'd discovered something unusual. When he got closer, he saw that they had surrounded someone lying on the ground and were punching, kicking, and generally trying their best to hurt him. Most of the men were unarmed, though one of them had a chain in his hand. Another held a black stick that looked like a policeman's baton. They wore unbuttoned, short-sleeved shirts. Some were in T-shirts, others in running shirts, most of them with hair dyed blonde or brown, some with tattoos on their arms. The young man they were beating and kicking was dressed much the same. As Nakata approached, tapping the asphalt surface with the tip of his umbrella, a couple of the men turned round and glared at him. They relaxed, though, when they saw it was only some harmless old man. "Why don't you beat it, Grandad?" one of them growled. Unperturbed, Nakata walked even closer. The man on the ground seemed to be bleeding from his mouth.
"Blood's coming out," Nakata said. "He might die."
Caught off guard, the men didn't react right away.
"Maybe we should kill you too while we're at it," the one with the chain said. "Killing one or two, no skin off my nose."
"You can't kill someone for no reason," Nakata insisted. "You can't kill someone for no reason," one of them mimicked, and his friends laughed.
"We got our reasons, pal," another man said, "and it ain't got nothing to do with you whether we kill him or not, so take your worthless umbrella and hit the road before it starts raining."
The man on the ground started crawling forward, and a young man with a shaved head came over and kicked him hard in the ribs with his work boots. Nakata closed his eyes. He could feel something welling up inside him, beyond his control. He felt slightly nauseous. The memory of stabbing Johnny Walker suddenly came back to him. His hand still remembered what it felt like to plunge a knife into a man's chest. Connections. Could this be one of those connections that Mr. Hagita was talking about? Eel equals knife equals Johnny Walker? The men's voices sounded distorted, and he couldn't tell them apart any more. Their voices blended together with the ceaseless drone of tires from the highway to make a strange tone. His heart surged blood to his extremities as night enveloped him. Nakata looked up at the sky, then slowly opened his umbrella and held it above him. Carefully he took a few steps backwards, opening a space between himself and the gang. He looked round, then took a few more steps back. The young men laughed when they saw this.
"Hey, look at the cool old guy," one of them said. "He's actually using his umbrella."
But they didn't laugh for long. Suddenly, unfamiliar, greasy objects began to rain down from the sky, striking the ground at their feet with a weird slap. The young men stopped kicking their prey and looked up at the sky. There weren't any clouds, but things were definitely falling one after another from somewhere above. At first in dribs and drabs, then gradually more and more fell, and before they knew it they were caught in a downpour. The objects pelting down from the sky were little black objects about an inch and a half long. In the lights of the car park it looked like slick black snow that was falling on the men's shoulders, arms and necks, and sticking there. Desperately they tried to yank the objects off, but couldn't.
"Leeches!" someone yelled.
As if given a signal, the men all shouted and raced across the car park to the toilets. One of them, a young blonde man, was knocked to the ground by a car he'd run in front of. He jumped up, slammed his fist on the hood of the car, and loudly cursed the driver. That was all, though, and he soon limped away towards the toilets. The leeches rained down hard for a time, then tapered off and stopped. Nakata folded up his umbrella, brushed off the leeches, and went over to see how the injured man was doing. A mound of the slimy creatures squirmed all around, so he couldn't get very close, and the man on the ground was buried in them. Looking closely, Nakata could see that he was bleeding from cut eyelids, and some of his teeth looked broken. Nakata knew this was too much for him to deal with by himself, so he hurried back to the restaurant and told one of the employees that a man was lying in the car park, hurt.
"You'd better call the police, or else he might die," he said.
Not long after this, Nakata found a lorry driver willing to give him a ride as far as Kobe. A sleepy-looking man in his 20s, not very tall, with a ponytail, a pierced ear, and a Chunichi Dragons baseball cap, he sat there in the restaurant, smoking and flipping through a comic book. A gaudy Aloha shirt and oversized Nikes completed his wardrobe. He tapped his cigarette ashes into the leftover soup in his bowl of ramen, stared hard at Nakata, then gave a reluctant nod.
"Yeah, okay, you can ride with me. You sort of remind me of my grandpa, the way you look, or maybe how you talk, kind of off the point. At the end, my grandpa got senile and died a few years ago."
He went on to explain that they should get to Kobe by morning. He was delivering furniture to a department store warehouse there. As he pulled his lorry out of the car park, they passed a car accident. Two patrol cars were already at the scene, red lights flashing, and a policeman with a signal light was directing traffic. It didn't appear to be much of an accident. A few cars had collided, the side of a minivan was dented, a car's tail light broken. The lorry driver stuck his head out the window and exchanged